WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guests Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover chronicle the changes in America's political culture. Since 1980, they've collaborated on a series of books offering postmortems of each presidential election. Their new book is called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars? The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. It recaps an election in which campaigns were run by hired guns rather than old friends in the party and decided on the basis of image rather than issues. Drummond and Woodcover write a nationally syndicated political column. Drummond is also a frequent guest on the McLaughlin Group and the Today Show. Both reporters have covered national politics for 30 years. I asked Jules Woodcover how reporters' relationships with candidates have changed since the 1960 elections.
The basic difference is that there's a much more protection of candidates, and candidates are much more self-protective. By that I mean they're more wary about saying things off the record or on a background basis because they've been getting burned. The advent of the tape recorder and the television handheld camera has been an intrusion to a lot of candidates. It made them very, very careful about what they'll say to reporters, and that has affected the relationship in a major way.
It's also true that the candidates are more afraid now that what they say on a background basis or on a off-the-record basis, unless it is to somebody they know very well, is going to get blown into a story because there are so many reporters covering campaigns now that the competitive pressures are somewhat higher than they were. And there are always sorts of people want to sort of prove their manhood or their womanhood by such stories.
Did you have more access to the candidates themselves back in 1960 than you do now?
Oh, yes. I think it's there's no question about it. One of the things that made reporting political campaigns fun in those days was that at the end of a day, the candidate would come back on the campaign bus or in the campaign plane and loosen his tie and have a few drinks with you and talk about things generally and about his own feelings about things so that you might not get something to write the next morning, usually didn't, but you got a feel for who this person was, and over a period of a campaign, you were better equipped to convey that judgment to the voters. Now, because of the attitude that exists with the presence of these devices that record voices and pictures, candidates are very, very, as I said, very wary of having that kind of open exchange.
You've gone back after several elections to write a book that chronicled how the election unfolded. So looking back not only over the elections that you've covered, but over the books that you've written, how does the 1988 campaign compare to the others? What's really unique about what happened in 1988?
Well, we've never had a campaign before, a presidential campaign in modern politics, that was sort of conducted at the level of a campaign for Sewer Commissioner of Buffalo. I mean, this was a particularly nasty campaign. We had a candidate, and this is new. We had one candidate, George Bush, accusing the other of a lack of patriotism, or a deficiency of patriotism. That is something we haven't had before. It was a pretty nasty campaign in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. In talking about things that have changed over the years, one of the major things that you mentioned is the proliferation of primaries and the grouping together of primaries on, for instance, Super Tuesday. How has that changed the nature of campaigning?
Well, for one thing, is that it has spread the candidates very thin, and it adds immeasurably to the frenetic nature of a campaign. Campaigns, particularly like you mentioned Super Tuesday, became campaigns that were conducted at airports, from one airport to another, candidates flying down, making a speech, and going on to the next state. One of the rationales for Super Tuesday was that it would bring more attention to these states, candidates would spend more time, but because there were so many primaries held on that date, candidates more often than not would just make a quick hit in a state and go on. So the people in that state, in those states, really were cheated.
My guests are syndicated columnists Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover. They've written a new book called Whose Broad Stripes and Bright Stars? The Trivial Pursuit of the Presidency, 1988. All reporters now have to go through a line of consultants and spin control doctors and so on. But you suggest that you think, in a way, reporters might be better off going through the consultants than they used to be, having access only to the to party leaders for information.
Well, I don't think we've said that in the book. Matter of fact, one of the points we made was that the domination of the so-called hired guns, the consultants, the pollsters, the various media experts, has taken the campaign to a large degree out of the hands of candidates. In the Bush campaign particularly, those people dictated the strategy, and George Bush was a very pliant performer for them.
No, but you're right about that. There is a point. We did make a point in the book that you're getting at, which is a little different. And that is that the value of consultants, or the sort of the symbiotic relationship between consultants and reporters, gets you a better picture of the campaign, in the sense that the consultant knows that he's going to be dealing with the same reporters 2 years down the road, 4 years down the road, six, eight, every even-numbered year, ad infinitum. And this puts some burden on the consultant to be reasonably credible in dealing with the press. And the fact is that the press, for that reason, often gets a better picture of a campaign than when they were dealing with, and I think this was the point we made, than when they were dealing with county chairman and state chairman, who were going to talk to you once and you were never going to see them again. And if they wanted to lie to you, that was there was no price to pay for them.
What do you think that the campaign has gone into the hands of consultants and spin control doctors? You watch a campaign now and you feel like you're not hearing the candidates speak, you're hearing their scriptwriters speak, and you're hearing the scriptwriters' one-liners. And even if that's always been the case to some degree, it certainly seems to be more so than ever now.
Well, part of it clearly is the sort of geometric progression and the increase in the influence of television, and particularly the evening news broadcasts on the networks every night, you know, 6:30 or 7 o'clock. And the voters have become, you know, as they have in everything else, they've become sort of spectators rather than participants. The day of big rallies is very rare these days. And they take their news and their picture of politics off these broadcasts. And the premium there, obviously, is in getting a visually attractive event that can make one point quickly and vividly.
George Bush ran a very negative campaign in 1988. What was the rationale for that in among his aides?
That it worked. They started out, they had a candidate in Bush who had, this is going back in the spring of 1988, they had a candidate who, although he was winning the Republican nomination, had very high negatives in the polls. A lot of people had a lot of doubts about him. A lot of people didn't like him. A lot of reservations about his ability and the force of his personality and whether he had any sort of there. The Bush people came upon through some polling data, focus group so-called, they came upon some obvious weaknesses in Dukakis. They set about to exploit those weaknesses in Dukakis as a way to change the focus of the campaign, hoping this would drive up Dukakis' negatives, which in fact it did, and that it would drive down Bush's negatives, which in fact it did. And what happened was it worked so much better than they expected, and Dukakis let them get away with it for so long, they just continued it all through the campaign. They never had to change.
Why did Dukakis let them get away with it?
Well, I think a lot of it goes to the kind of man he is. Dukakis did not favor the demeaning of a campaign. He had a kind of an academic approach toward the presidential campaign. He thought certain issues were worthy of being discussed at the presidential campaign level and others not. He also thought that some of these other issues that were brought against him not only were not worthy to be in a presidential campaign, but would not be effective. He made a very, very serious mistake there. He could not bring himself to believe, for instance, that the fact that he had vetoed a bill in Massachusetts that would have required the teachers to lead the students in the Pledge of Allegiance would be an issue that could be damaging to him. By the same token, the information that the Republicans got about his prison furlough program, the so-called Willie Horton case, he didn't believe that that was presidential either and that that could hurt him, and he learned the hard way that it could.
Did you talk to any of Dukakis' consultants and ask them what they would have done differently?
Oh, we talked to all of them. and at the time, too, not just after the campaign, after during the campaign and after. And many of them, I mean, there was no question that there were some people in that campaign who were urging Dukakis to do it differently. Dukakis, though, has his own mind about what he's going to do on some of these things. He's willing to take consultants' advice and direction only up to a point. And as Jules just said, he became convinced these issues were trivial and were not presidential, and he was just stubborn about it.
So what do you think presidential candidates in 1992 will take away from the successful negative campaign of 1988?
Well, I think they'll take away the basic lesson, as Jack indicated earlier, that it works. We saw it before at 1988 in local elections. We're seeing it again after 1988, where more and more candidates are going to negative campaigning on the advice of professional handlers. There was a time that it was kind of axiomatic in politics that you did not attack your opponent, you did not go negative, until you had established yourself firmly as a positive candidate, that you gave the voters reasons to vote for you and have a positive attitude about you. That's gone by the boards now. Now candidates come out of the gate attacking the other guy, and they will probably continue to do that as long as there are indications, strong indications that it works. If there should be some backlash, as there have been in a couple of elections, perhaps we'll see a cleaner election next time, but I wouldn't bet the farm on it.
You quote something that Bush's media advisor Roger Ailes said in terms of the response that they were getting from the media. He said, "We felt that we were doing reasonably well in the evening news, but we thought it was because we were giving the networks what they wanted. They either want mistakes, pictures, or attacks, and we were giving them pretty good pictures and pretty good lead stories, and we were sticking to our theme of the day, whatever that was. We were disciplined, giving them the sound bites and the feed that they wanted. It wasn't that they were rolling over for us. It was that we were basically programming something that they would air, and therefore we were basically doing our job at that time." There's something very scary about that quote, you know, that they thought of themselves as programming the evening news.
Well, that's exactly right. If you had to give a trophy for the most valuable player of the 1988 political season, it probably would have gone to Roger Ailes. In fact, we think the networks did roll over for the Bush campaign. One of the things we did in writing this book was we took the three commercial networks' evening news broadcasts for every night from the day after the Republican convention through the first debate in Winston-Salem, which was about 35 days, and went through and examined very carefully what they did, what they decided was news on those 35 nights. And it was very clear that the Bush campaign controlled the agenda. They were always on the offensive. They were always providing an interesting visual, an interesting picture, which is what television loves. And Dukakis, except on one or two occasions, was usually a fellow standing in front of a blue curtain at a podium defending himself against the previous day's charges. It was a disaster for him. And it may have been what decided the whole thing right there.
Let's look at some of the behind-the-scenes information that you chronicle in your new book. Let's look at the debates. A question that really kind of knocked out Dukakis was a question that was posed by Bernard Shaw, that if Kitty Dukakis was raped and murdered, would Dukakis favor an irrevocable death penalty? Now, he was really criticized for coming off like really cold in his answer to this, for not at all recognizing the emotional subject matter of it, and then for going astray into all these other subjects. You say he was actually prepared for a question like that, and he had a prepared answer, which he didn't use.
Yes, well, he was not prepared for that specific question. Nobody dreamed that he would be asked a question so specific about his wife. But he was prepared for a question about his attitude toward crime, because Bush had been accusing him of being soft on crime. And the answer that he was going to give went something like this. My father was attacked and mugged in his office. I have a brother who was killed by a hit-and-run driver who we believe was under the influence of alcohol and drugs. I've experienced violence and crime in my own life, and I don't need any lessons from George Bush or anybody else about how to be tough on crime. But he didn't give the answer, and that was one of the most baffling things about the Dukakis performance.
Why didn't he give that answer? Did you find out?
No, that's the... You know, that's the mystery. Nobody knows. He doesn't know himself. He can't. It's impossible to explain. He just didn't connect it with the question. I guess he was startled. But you know what? The point about, I mean, the killing thing about that question is, there are these things that happen in campaigns that Lee Atwater, the Republican chairman who was Bush's campaign manager, likes to call defining moments in campaigns. And defining moments are those that are particular exchanges or moments on television that crystallize questions or doubts about candidates, or resolve them sometimes, but that are moments that are, you know, rebroadcast and that make people's opinions come together. And that bloodless response that Dukakis gave to that question sort of crystallized all the reservations about whether he had a human side, which in fact he does have, and was a killer.
My guests are Jack Drummond and Jules Woodcover. I'd like to ask you a few questions about your own approach to reporting. You've been a team together for how many years now?
12 years. 12 long years.
How did you start working together?
Well, we were competitors for many years covering politics. And in 1977, Jules was working for the Washington Post, and I was working for the Washington Star. And we had talked about doing this kind of column for some years. And he was getting so close to doddering retirement age, I thought we better get started. So we came together in 1977, and at the Star is where we started, and been doing it ever since.
What's your technique for working together on a story, both in terms of the reporting and the writing?
Well, I usually do all the reporting and all the writing, and then the Jack delivers the column to the syndicate. seriously. We have a very good working relationship. We don't keep score. We write five newspaper columns and a magazine column every week. That's six columns a week. It's a lot of work. We discuss the material we're going to work on. One person usually reports and writes the column, and the other will assist him with information that he gets that will add to the column. And very occasionally, we may actually sit down and collaborate on a column. I think what really has made it go for this long is that each of us wants to do a little more than the other. So we don't have any feeling that anybody is slacking. We don't keep score. We've written six columns a week for 12 years. I have no idea how many of them Jack has written, how many I have written. And we don't have particular days. When a column is ready to go, it goes. Sometimes Jack will write four columns in a row, and sometimes I will.
Can people tell your writing style apart?
Yeah, if it's in English, I usually have written it. No, the fact is there are differences. The columns that have a lot of sentences that begin and but, those are ones I've written. Columns that have sentences begin also, comma, Jules has written. That's one way you can tell us apart.
Jules Woodcover. Now Jack Drummond is on the McLaughlin Group every week.
That's his responsibility. Don't ask me to explain it.
Well, I want you to explain how come he's doing so much TV and you're not.
Well, because he's the tall, dark, and handsome one.
Is that all you're going to say about it?
It's because I have an infinite tolerance for nonsense.
Well, let me ask you, if you ever get frustrated on the McLaughlin Group, it's one of those shows where everybody disagrees, and you know what they're going to disagree on as soon as the topic's brought up. It's a real kind of free-for-all brawl that might be actually very well rehearsed beforehand. I don't know, but is it ever a frustrating experience for you?
No, it's not rehearsed at all. And it's not frustrating to me because it is not something that I take seriously. I mean, it is. You show up and you do 30 minutes of arguing back and forth, but it is not serious journalism, and no one is more aware of that than I am.
Then why do you do it?
For the money.
Uh-huh.
That's the best reason.
Well, that's interesting. One last question for you both. What is the function for you of publishing after each election a detailed chronicle of what took place in that presidential campaign?
Well, on the most practical level, it keeps our names and work before the political community. people that we have to go to work our to do our column every day. It opens doors for us in places around the country where perhaps our column doesn't appear. But also, I think beyond that, it's very helpful to go back after the campaign and sort it out. It all happens. I know the public thinks it lasts forever, but for us, it goes pretty quickly, day after day, and we don't have a lot of time to reflect. Well, I found it very helpful, and I think Jack has too, to after the campaign to sit down, sift it all through, and make some judgments about what really it all means that we haven't been able to do because of the rush of events.
There is one other. It is a when you finished, Jules had written several books before we became partners, and I don't think I ever would have done a book if we hadn't become partners. We've done three now like this together, and I find them as noxious as they are to work on sometimes. I find it worthwhile because when you finish the book, the research for the book, you think you know more about that campaign than any other reporter in the world because you have gone back over all this ground. We did 80-some interviews for this book after the fact. Our last book, I think we did over 100 interviews after the fact. And that helps you write a better column for the next 4 years because you can say with the authority of really knowing it that X and Y or so or such happened. Not all of which was that clear at the end of the campaign.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Thank you.